All right, we'll get started here. This session is Latin expendable or indispensable. It's being taught by our tutor here at Blackboard Study Center, Mrs. Sharon Sampson.
Okay, welcome. This is sort of a two-pronged talk, and I usually speak on Latin each year at this conference, and it sometimes takes a little bit of a different direction. This year, we're going to look at two different aspects. The first is why study Latin, and then for the second part, we're actually going to dig into some Latin, and I'll have you look at sort of what an introductory look at a Latin program would look like. So we're kind of accomplishing two goals here in one session. But our title is Latin, Expendable or Indispensable. And Charles, I forget which of the first two speakers now, we were talking about defining terms and the importance of it. So I thought we should begin with defining our terms. We're talking about whether Latin is expendable or indispensable. So I went to the Oxford Compact Dictionary online to get us a working definition of both of those terms. And I thought it was interesting that one was very short and one was rather long. And the definition for indispensable was absolutely necessary. And so I thought, well, that pretty much sums it up. So something that's indispensable is absolutely necessary. For expendable, it was interesting because their definition was much longer. And something that's expendable is able to be sacrificed because of little significance when compared to an overall purpose. So again, something that's expendable is able to be sacrificed because of little significance when compared to an overall purpose. So those will be our two working definitions that we'll talk about compared to Latin and other things as well. So since we are talking about Latin, we're gonna start with the question, why study Latin? Now, are any of you currently already involved in a homeschool program that includes Latin? Okay, so the rest of you are considering it or wondering why you should consider it? Okay, great. So why? Why should we do it? Is it really worth your time as a homeschooler or your money if you choose to outsource this portion of your child's education? Because a lot of people do everything at home. Other people will find tutors, online programs that they will then pay for to outsource. So the question is Latin worth either of those things? Is it worth your time as a homeschooler learning it, having to dig in yourself, or paying someone else to do that for you? So we're going to take a look at some of the benefits of studying Latin, and hopefully that will help you gain a perspective. From my perspective as a Latin tutor, I decided it would be fun to gain and to give you a perspective broader than just my own. And because I teach at Blackburn Study Center, I thought it would be interesting to send an email out to all of my parents and say, how have your children benefited from studying Latin, or why do you think it's important for them to study Latin? And that was great. I really appreciated their comments, and so I'll be sharing some of those throughout my talk. And while most of them did give a nod to some of the commonly held reasons for studying Latin, they shared some unique insights as well. So among the top typical reasons for studying Latin are increased test scores. That's been historically one of the things that you hear people talk about. And also greater familiarity with vocabulary in general. And so those are things that you hear about commonly. And related to vocabulary, not just vocabulary in general, but specifically in the areas of law, medicine, when you get into those types of fields, a knowledge and a background in Latin are very helpful and beneficial to those. And on the second page of your sheet, I listed some references at the bottom. There's a website that's the Promote Latin, and if you would go to that website, you will see a lot of these commonly held benefits of studying Latin. It's an organization that's classical and classical language studies, and so they talk about some of those types of things. So those are definitely common reasons. And of course, if we desire our children to get into good schools, test scores are important, and those are great reasons. And if they are aspiring to go into some of these careers where a background in Latin would be beneficial, of course, it's helpful as well. And from a vocabulary standpoint in general, over 60% of our English words are derived from Latin. When we get to words that are greater than three syllables, I think it goes up over 90%. So a knowledge of how language works, the derivatives that have come from Latin, is a benefit as well. And regard to vocabulary and reading, one of my parents shared with me about her third or fourth grade son. He can read well, but he doesn't do it unless it's been assigned. However, I have noticed this year that his vocabulary is improving. I believe some of it is because of Latin and studying the derivatives, and this is a first-year student. He is also enjoying reading more these days. Maybe that is also from Latin because it gives him confidence in himself when he knows he's studying something different than other kids in our neighborhood. So it's also a confidence builder. So this particular parent was sharing that for her son, for this particular son, she really feels like the study of Latin and the increased understanding and vocabulary is actually encouraging him to be more of a reader than he has been in the past, unlike her older son, who's much more of an avid reader. So she felt that was definitely helping him. And so that is, again, one of the commonly held benefits, that it helps you in that sense in terms of vocabulary. But when we really think about it, though, and my husband's here today, and he and I talked about this, he was an avid reader and has a wonderful vocabulary. So the argument on the other side is, well, if our children are just good readers, their vocabulary will be increased. They will be very knowledgeable just by reading. So should we, should that be reason enough to study Latin? And I would say that no, you can. If you're just a good reader, you can gain a lot of vocabulary by doing that without a study of Latin. So while that's a good reason, it's not the reason that I think would tip people over into spending years studying Latin so they can have a better vocabulary. Also, the whole idea that our culture is based on Greco-Roman ideals and culture and history. When we look at that, I think when we study the ancient cultures, we begin to see the connections to our own culture. So that is another benefit of studying Latin. There's so much related to our history, our government, monuments that really connect back to those classical languages and those cultures. And our students don't have that. They miss that. They miss that whole idea of connection to the past. And one parent shared an example of that. Again, this is a family fairly new to Latin. She said, "I love the fact that it gives us a sense of being part of the continuum of history. I know this is sort of an abstract notion, but as we were watching the Adams Chronicles, the PBS documentary about John Adams' family, there was a great scene where John Quincy, sitting at the table, was complaining to his mother Abigail about studying Latin, with Abigail maintaining her stand about the importance of his studies. It made us all laugh, as we have had that very occurrence at our dining room table. But it also gave us a sense of belonging to an important heritage." And I think, and that's really a big piece behind classical education as a whole. You are beginning at the beginning, and you are coming forward. You're not studying American history in isolation. It's not all about me. It's not all about us. We are connected to something else. And so that connection, especially we as a Western culture, our heritage, so much of it has come from the Greco-Roman world, and so it really does help our children have an understanding of what has gone on before. So I think that's another valid reason, and fairly common that people are familiar with and accept. In addition to polling my parents, I also sent an email off to my daughter, who's a freshman at Grove City College and had 6 years of Latin study. And so I sent her the same question I sent my parents, and I said, how did you benefit from studying Latin? Why do you think Latin is important? And she said, "I think the importance and structure of grammatical forms is great training for the brain in terms of memorization ability and in terms of recognizing and applying forms you've learned. Almost like math without the numbers." And when I read that, the first thing I did was laugh, because while she was very proficient in math, she always hated it in our homeschooling. And so I thought that was very interesting. So it gave me a chuckle to start with, and I thought that would be like her to make that kind of comment. And so I set my emails aside and started to begin to put together what I wanted to talk about today. And I thought about what she said, like math without the numbers. And then I pulled some files that I have on classical education that I hadn't looked through in a few years. The first thing that I came across was an article called "An Apology for Latin and Math." written by Cheryl Lowe, who is the author of the Latina Christiana Latin Curriculum, which is what I use for the younger children here at Blackburn Study Center. And so I thought, that's so interesting. Here's the title of an article that immediately strikes me as being about the same thing that my daughter just said in this email. I thought, I've got to read this email. I've got to dig into it. And so also referenced on your handout is this online article by Cheryl Lowe, and I commend it to you. It's a great article. And for the next few minutes, I will be sharing many of her thoughts from this article, because this really grabbed my attention. And a few years back, I did a talk here at Blackburn on why study Latin, and I would say that at that point in time, it really focused on some of these commonly held benefits that I've already mentioned, you know, the vocabulary and the test scores and the connection with the past and those types of things. And I decided to go a little bit of a different direction today because of this article, so I would definitely recommend that you go read that. And while Cheryl Lowe certainly agrees with all of those things that I've already mentioned, because they're all great goals, she points out that there are more important objectives that Latin achieves besides those, and that Latin achieves them better than any other subject. And the two things that she mentions are mental development and English language skills. So I would say, as far as our outline goes, the real value of Latin study, our second point there, that's what we're going to talk about, the mental development and the English language skills. She proposes that Latin develops the intellectual powers of the mind as no other subject can, and likens this to a student athlete versus a couch potato. Okay, so the student who studies Latin is that student athlete of the mind versus someone who sits and does nothing physically. She explains that the process of learning Latin is much like learning math, because it's systematic, organized, orderly, logical, and cumulative. Okay, so when we look at, and if you're not familiar with Latin, if you're not familiar with a language that is inflected, very different than our own, you know, perhaps that might be a little bit foreign, but I think it's a great connection with math, because we all understand how math is that way and how it progresses through, and you can't keep going if you haven't mastered what has come before. And so that's the connection with math. Like math, Latin forms the mind of the student to accuracy, logical thinking, and problem solving. And she makes the statement that it's formation, not information. And so much of our education is about information and getting information into the mind. And so I like that statement. It's formation, not just information. This is different than all of our other subjects in our schooling, aside from math, where we learn information that doesn't always build on what has come before. If we don't do well in biology, we might be fine in chemistry. And if we don't like the ancient authors, we might think Shakespeare is great. So we can pass through a lot of different subjects without really worrying about how well we've mastered what has come before. And again, in terms of classical education, I think we fail when we don't have that cumulative nature, because I don't think we can understand American history if we haven't understood the history that has come before. So there's definitely a cumulative nature. And with authors, Ty Fisher was talking about Dante. Well, you know, if you understand the classical authors, you know, you understand what Dante has done. And there are these connections, and so they're all important. But from a mind-building standpoint, one doesn't necessarily have to occur for the other. So she goes on to ask what we have on the language side of the curriculum that is comparable to and that balances the rigorous, challenging, cumulative, formative study of math. Because nobody leaves math behind, and, you know, we're required by the state in Pennsylvania to teach mathematics, so we never leave math behind. So she asks the question of, well, what do we have on the language side that gives us that same benefit that math has? And her answer is, without Latin, we have nothing. Now, she does go on to say that the same benefits can be achieved through a study of classical Greek or something like German, you know, some of the other languages that have the same type of structure to them. But I think that's very, very telling to consider the possibility that without something like that, we're actually leaving a whole. And it's not a whole of information. It's really a whole of formation, of the formulation of how we think and how we process. Because in terms of information, we can learn information about anything at any point in our lives. And as homeschool parents, if we don't hit on, you know, seashells or specific types of bugs or something, our kids at any point in time can go and read about those things. But when we look at actual formation and learning to think and process and put things together in a cumulative way, I think that's very telling to consider that something like Latin is so fundamental, so important in helping us with that. The article goes on to address the fact that English does not provide that for us, because that's a question that somebody might ask. Well, okay, if study of language is important and structure and so on, can't we just accomplish that in our study of English? And her answer in the article is no. And she goes on to say, and it's interesting to see when you go to these different sessions to see sort of a thread that continues through, and that, you know, one person picks up on something someone else will say. Charles Jackson was talking in the last section. We were talking about how individualistic we are as a nation and even as a church and so on. And so she makes the comment that that's true with English, and that's one of the problems. You know, that English is so individualistic and it's so lax that it just doesn't have the same type of structure that trains and teaches the mind in the way that Latin does. And I think we can see that in, you know, when you see the articles in the newspaper, new dictionary definitions. We add words into the dictionary because somebody has come up with some new individualistic way of saying something, like ginormous. I know it was one of the ones that recently made it into Webster. And so, you know, we come up with some new way we want to say something, and we put it in the dictionary. So she makes the case that that's why English doesn't work. It doesn't, and it's also only a mildly inflected language, and we'll get into talking a little bit about that, that the structure, the form, is not there in English in the same kind of way that we have in Latin or Greek or something like German. And so you've got that laxness compared to something like Latin that's systematic and rigorous and analytical. You really need to look at it and really think about it. And I have a quote by a classicist named Charles Bennett in the idea that Latin helps develop English skills better than English. He said, "The study of one's own language is achieved incomparably better by the indirect method of studying another language." And that was the second point that Cheryl Lowe makes in her article. You know, the first one is mental development, and the second one is just our own knowledge of English grammar. He goes on to say, "It's because translation from Latin to English is so helpful for the student who would attain mastery of his own language that I find the full justification for the study of Latin." And these same thoughts, I thought, were summed up nicely by two other parents who responded to my request. One who just simply said, "Latin is great for making the students' minds work hard and logically." And another one who said, "Besides it reinforcing any grammar study of their native language, it is a disciplined, categorical approach to thinking which they need for many disciplines." And I think that's the other piece. We look at it just in isolation and we say, well, Latin, why would I want to do that? But when we look at it in terms of the giving the ability to think and process and analyze, that having to do that by studying this language then gives the mind an ability to take that and apply it to all other areas of study. You know, it's not something that's just its own little thing. It has broad application. And the parent summarized by saying, "It's like putting together a beautiful puzzle when translating." And, it, you know, if you've ever done this type of language study, it is so much fun. And I see it on the kids' faces when they actually know what something means. When I put it up on the board and they can't wait to tell me that they understand what it says. They can figure out every piece of that puzzle and pull it all together. So that's a little bit of why I think we should study Latin, some of the commonly held benefits. And I think this whole idea of mental formation, I think that's probably not as commonly held. I think that's something that people don't think about. They tend to think about the practical things that I can look at. Wow, and on that second website that I gave you, you can go on there and they'll show you the statistics for SAT scores and students who have studied a classical language score so many points higher than other students. You know, that's very practical. But when we think of the formation of the mind, the training for thinking, that's maybe a little more abstract, but I think a whole lot more important. So what we're going to do now, the next part of your seminar outline is how does an inflected language like Latin work? So we're going to actually jump in and talk specifically about Latin. And this is the part where my husband leaves the seminar, because Latin makes him laugh. But it's because my daughter and I always know what we're talking about, and he doesn't know what we're talking about. So first of all, an inflected language, and I tell the kids what we mean inflected, not infected, okay? And an inflected language really means where we've got endings on words that tell us things. And my classic example in class is I tell the children, if I say, Mary rides a horse, do you know what I mean? And they say, yes, they know what I mean. And I say, well, what if I switch the words around and I say, the horse rides Mary? And they all laugh. And I say, well, why are you laughing? And I say, well, that doesn't make sense, Mrs. Sampson. I said, why? Well, you switch the words around. And I said, oh, okay. So does it make a difference where I put the words? Yes, it does. And that's how English works. It's all about word order. And if we take the same three words and we put them in a different order, we have a completely different result. Whereas in Latin and in other inflected language, such as Greek or German specifically, we've got all these various endings that we put on words. And it's those endings that tell us the jobs that the words are doing. So I can actually shuffle the words in a different order in Latin and not change the meaning at all, because it's the ending on the word that tells us what it's doing. So that's kind of a very basic description of an inflected language. English is considered I was on Wikipedia yesterday. I think it called English a mildly inflected language or weakly inflected language. Because we still do, we can talk about subjects and verbs have to agree. And if I say, he sit on a horse, you immediately know that that's not right. You would say, well, it should be he sits on a horse. I sit, but he sits. Well, that's an inflection of in a sense. So we still have a little bit of that in English, but Latin is considered highly inflected. It's all about the endings. So we're going to jump in and talk a little bit about nouns and verbs. And so I think we said we only have one person who has done Latin at all. Did anybody study Latin in school?
1 year?
Okay, amo, amas, amat. That's pretty much all you remember? Yeah. Okay, so we're going to start with talking about verbs, okay? The first word having to do with verbs is on your outline, and it's the word conjugation. And you've probably, if you've never heard this word in terms of language study, you've probably heard of it in terms of marriage, okay? When we get married, we have our conjugal vows. Maybe you've heard that phrase. To conjugate just means to join together. So that's why in marriage they're called conjugal vows. They're the vows that join us together as husband and wife. So in Latin, with verbs, we have conjugations. And so what we're doing, and I tell the kids this, and you know, third and fourth and fifth grade kids love this, to talk about marriage. I said, well, Latin verbs get married, and they all kind of giggle. But they do. Verbs and pronouns marry each other in Latin. Okay? And so the second thing listed on your outline are pronoun endings. And you'll see the letters O, S, T, and then next to them, mus, tis, and nt. So these are Latin pronoun endings. Okay. Now, in English, we have pronouns. We have I, you, he, she, it, we, you, plural, and they. And that's how they line up with these. So if you're writing on your outline, the letter O is the pronoun I, the first person singular I. And I have these lined up so the singular are on your left and the plural are on your right. So O stands for I, S stands for you, singular, T stands for he, she, it, mus stands for we, tis is you, plural, which I use as y'all because then the kids know what I'm talking about, And then the NT is they. Okay? And depending how sharp you are on your English grammar, you also see that they're lined up in rows for first, second, and third person. Okay, so our first person is on the top line, singular and plural. Our second person, singular and plural. And our third person, singular and plural. Now, one of the coolest things that I think about, well, not one of the coolest things, I think so much about Latin is cool, but one of the things that I really love, and especially in terms of when we're translating from the Latin version of the Bible, there is never any confusion between you singular and you plural. When we're reading through Scripture and Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you," we may have to look at a footnote to see, is Jesus speaking to Peter specifically at that point in time, or is he speaking to everybody who is gathered there? And if you have a study Bible, it might say, you know, in the Greek, plural. Okay? So in English, we have lost that sense of singular versus plural in the second person. So with my students, we say you and y'all, because then we know what we're talking about in English. But if you look at the Latin, if my word ending has an S on it, it's you singular, and Jesus is talking to Peter. If we have T-I-S, if we have T's, Jesus is talking to more than one person. And so I really like that in Latin, like I said, when we're looking at the Bible, we can actually tell, and Greek is the same way. Is he talking to one person or more than one? So this is where we begin. This is the very beginnings of a basic Latin program. The students start memorizing it. And the other thing we didn't mention when to start studying Latin, early elementary school is the perfect time. And in, I think it's, I'm not sure whether if it's Cheryl Lowe or one of the other authors who has spoken on classical education, talks about the ability of our children to memorize at young ages. And talks about how, you know, for them to walk around chanting Latin forms is no different than chanting their alphabet or eeny, meeny, miny, mo, that young children have an ability to memorize that diminishes as we get older. And so the younger they are, the more they can absorb. And I have heard that I only had one child, but families with younger children aren't studying Latin yet, but they hear their older brothers and sisters, you know, chanting their forms, and, you know, you turn around and they know them. And nobody even said that they should know them. It's just they sound fun. So you begin by chanting O-S-T, moose, tis, nt. I, you, he, she, it, we, y'all, they. And so in no time at all, they have made the connection. And for some students, it takes longer. You know, then I've got to go back and think through, well, O means I and S means you. But you just begin to learn it. You begin to memorize it. And so we'll take a look at some specific verbs a little bit later. But what we do with these pronoun endings, they then go on the end of a verb. So I have a chant that I teach the children that helps them to remember. So in Latin, one word can be a whole sentence because the pronoun ending is on the end of the verb. So I can have one word like amat. Amo is I love is the first word that is ever taught in most Latin curricula. Amo means I love. So that O on the end of amo is the I, and then the other part is the stem that's the meaning of the verb. And so one word can be a whole sentence. But every verb has encompassed in that verb who is doing that action. So you look at that one word, and it not only tells you what the action is, but it tells you who is doing it. And again, we don't have that in English. If I say rides, well, who? Who is it that's riding? But when we look at the Latin word, that O-S-T, mus, tis, nt, tells us who is doing that action. So that's the basics of verb structure. We have the action that's being done, and then the pronoun on the end that tells us who is doing that action. So that's a verb at its basic form. The next section is nouns. Nouns also come in groups. And I guess I should say that the conjugations, to conjugate means to put the endings on the verbs. But conjugations are also groups of nouns. And we probably won't have time to get into all of that, but groups of verbs. Every verb belongs to one of four conjugations. And then there are ways that we know which group each verb belongs to. So there are four groups of verbs altogether. Every verb in the world belongs to one of those four groups and acts like the other verbs that belong to its group. When we get to nouns, we use the word declension. And there are five declensions. So every noun in the world belongs to one of five groups. And this is helpful to the children because initially they think, oh, I've got all these endings to memorize. And I think, take every noun in the world. Everything God has ever created is a noun. Every single one of them goes into only one of five groups. When they think, oh, I've got to memorize all this. Well, there's only five sets. And every noun in the world goes into one of these five. So a declension is a group of nouns. And our nouns all belong to one of these five declensions. And some of the declensions hardly have any nouns in them at all. And then the students want to know, well, why did they have to come up with that declension? Couldn't they have just put them in? And then I say, I don't know. I wasn't around when they thought this up. So the declensions are the groups of nouns. The next item on your outline is genders. Now, if you've studied other languages, like the other Romance language, other Romance languages like French or Spanish, you're familiar with the fact that some of the other languages have genders, and you've got to worry about something whether something is masculine or feminine. And we still have, and the kids have a really hard time with that. They understand that mother would be feminine and that father would be masculine, but then they don't understand why table is feminine. And again, well, I don't know. You know, somewhere way back in history, somebody decided the table was feminine, and that's just the way it is. And gift is neuter, and horse is masculine. So they initially they have a little bit of trouble getting their hands around that. But we still have carryovers of that in our language today. English does not have gender, but we still have some carryover from these languages of old. For example, the word ship. What gender is ship? Right, how do we know that? Okay. Oh, and they refer to a ship as her. Okay. I'm trying to think of another word where we still have that. Oh, can somebody think of another example where we still can call something by its gender? I don't think we had a word for car in Latin, did we? I think we had some, what's that? Oh, Mother Earth. Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, Earth is also feminine. So we have just some vague, you know, kind of remembrances of that in English. But again, if you've studied French or Spanish, I'm thinking of particularly, you had masculine and feminine, and you had to think, is it L or La or, you know, that type of thing. So we have this idea of genders, and the students have to learn that. But in Latin, we have three. We not only have masculine and feminine, we have neuter. Okay, so they've got three genders that they need to learn there. And the big box underneath case jobs and endings. This is where Latin is different than something like Spanish. In Spanish, you do conjugate verbs. Do we have anybody who studied Spanish? Okay, if you jumped in and started looking at Latin, you would see a lot of similarities in that verbs conjugate, and they actually conjugate in very similar ways in Spanish. To how they do in Latin, which was fascinating when my daughter moved to her Spanish studies, and she would write sentences and then say, tell me what they mean. And I never studied Spanish, and very often I could translate her sentences because there are so many similarities, not only in vocabulary, but just how verbs conjugate. So in Spanish and in French as well, verbs conjugate in much the same way as they do in Latin. But when we get to nouns... Probably. I'm not as familiar with Italian, but French, Romanian, Italian, Portuguese, and Spanish are the five Romance languages that have their roots in Latin, so I would suspect that they would. Now, why it's different when we move to nouns, I don't know. But when we move into nouns, I know at least for Spanish, for sure, French, I'm not sure about, you don't have this same structure with nouns that you find in Latin. So what I've given you is what I hope is a simple chart that gives the main cases of Latin. And the way I describe this to the students is, I say, think of your father going to work, and he takes a briefcase. He takes a briefcase because it has the stuff for his job, okay? His briefcase is about the job that he does. Well, in Latin, the cases are about the job that the noun does. Now, again, in English, we don't have this. Where we put the word shows what its job is, okay? When Mary rides the horse, The way where we put those words tells us that Mary's the subject, rides is the verb, and then what's horse? You test your English grammar. Right, horse is the direct object. If I make it the horse rides Mary, by moving the words, I have made the horse the subject and Mary the direct object. Okay? That's how English works. And we're still they still have their jobs, their noun jobs, the subject noun or the direct object. So in Latin, we go to this chart at the bottom of your first page, and we see that it's not about where we put the word, it's about the endings that we put on it that tell us the noun job. And those are called case endings. And so it's a good connection for the children to say, well, a case ending is the noun job, just like your dad's briefcase is for his job. That's something that can help them understand that. And so the five main cases are the nominative, genitive, dative, accusative, and ablative. There are a few other ones, but those are the five primary cases in Latin. And next to each one of those names, I've given you the noun job. Okay? So a noun that would be in the nominative case would be the subject of the sentence. And then I've just given you examples for both the first declension feminine and second declension masculine. Okay? So if I have a first declension noun like earth, I would put either that letter A on the end of it if I wanted it to be a singular subject, or if you go straight across from it, I would put the AE ending on it if I wanted it to be the plural subject. Okay? So the nominative is for the subject. So, and I put the appropriate ending on it. So technically, if you want to be funny in Latin, there is a particular word order that we follow, and the subject noun is typically the first word in the sentence, just like it is in English. But we can make it the last word in the sentence if we want, because it's the ending that tells us what job that noun is doing. So I don't allow the children to do that because that would mess with my mind and I'd have to think about what they were trying to do. So there is a word order that Latin follows as well, but it's not the word order that's important, it's the endings. So the nominative case is our subject. The second case is the genitive, and we call that the of case or the possessive. So if we were talking about Mrs. Sampson's class, well, you would put my name in with a genitive ending because it's my class. It's the possessive. So again, it's the ending that tells us the job. The dative, we call it the 2-4 case, or for the indirect object. So if we've got a sentence and we have an indirect object, we just put the appropriate endings on it. For the first declension, it would be either the AE or the is, singular or plural.
Can I ask?
Sure.
How could you tell then, if you were to say Mrs. Sampson's daughters, both of the endings would have the AE?
Right. And that's where word order does become important.
Okay,
the question that's being asked is, in the first declension especially, we've got repeat endings. And how do we know whether it's this one singular or that one plural? That's where context is important as well, and word order. So, yeah, very good question. Thank you. The accusative is for the direct object. So if we have a direct object, we would put the om or the os. And then the simple definition of the ablative is the by, with, from case. And you would recognize that as prepositional phrases, used for prepositional phrases. I left my shoes by the door. Okay, we would use a preposition, an ablative ending. And again, in English, we have this whole prepositional phrase, by the door. Well, in Latin, we'd possibly just have the word for door with the right ending. So the Romans were very concise in their language, and then they would even leave certain verbs out. But there was sort of a concision where, you know, it took less to say. And I think Spanish, it takes an awful lot to say things, doesn't it? Okay, you know, something very simple that, you know, we would say in English takes five words in Spanish. But the Romans were, you know, they were very tight with their language. And so we can say a lot with a little. So, and when we begin teaching, again, with younger students especially, it works with older students like me because I didn't start studying Latin until 10 years ago. I was a bomb in French in high school, which is really interesting because I feel I have a knack for language, but for some reason that wasn't cultivated, and I bombed out, and I wish I could go back and take French. And actually, now that I've been studying Latin, French is in my head all the time. So I would also argue that there is something about that language center of our brain that when you open it up, whatever's in there comes out. And so it's amazing to me that I can want to say something to my students in Latin and the first thing that comes to me is French. And I was a C student, and I think I only took 1 year. And so it's very interesting what we remember. But the younger the students are, the more they remember. And so what we do is we teach them these endings in chant form. I don't give them this chart, and they don't begin by saying, well, this is the singular for this, and this is the plural for this. At the very basic stage, they're just learning the endings. Okay, for the verbs, they're chanting O-S-T, moose, tis, nt. And then I have them chant the pronoun endings as well. I, you, he, she, it, we, all, they. So they know them in the right order. The nouns are the same way. So they go around. So we start with the first declension, and it's always the singular first and then the plural. It's really important. And this is classical Latin study. There are Latin programs out there that are whole language and immersion. They never teach forms. It occurs to you at some point that this certain ending means this thing. Or verbs are taught with he does this, and that's your vocabulary word, and you're never really sure how to say I did it or we did it. So in a classical approach to Latin, you are memorizing these forms at a very young age. And Dorothy Sayers, in her article on classical education, she talks about that, and you know, sitting at the dining room table and you know having to chant all these forms of table with her father, and it didn't make sense to her. And initially it doesn't to them, because you can't take a third grade child and fully explain to them all this grammar. But they can walk around chanting a e e am a e arum is as is. And they know all those endings. Then over time through the program, then we gradually unfold all the meanings of these things. And again, it complements their studies of English beautifully. They so much more understand their own language by studying it in this very detailed, structured kind of way. The second declension, masculine, us, e, o, o, e, orum, is, os, is. And so they just very naturally, and again, you know, as you hear those, hopefully you're thinking, yeah, that just kind of makes sense. It's just kind of a fun thing to say, and they learn it very well. Now, for different children, it may take longer to unpack all that, for them to be able to understand it and apply it, but the actual memorization of it is very easy. So we're going to move to the second page of your outline. And I'm actually going to do some work with you. We're going to have a very small vocabulary list here. And I'll try and take you through and show you how some of this works. So our word bank is going to be the word for girl, which is puella, and aquus, which is horse, Maria, which is Mary, aqua, which is water, and then two verbs. And the first verb is do, which means I give. And the second verb is lavo, which means I wash. And I think what I want to do here, do we have? We do. I didn't give you the conjugations of these two verbs on your sheet, and I'm going to go ahead and put these up for us. Okay, this is what the conjugation of both of those verbs would look like. And hopefully, now if I was doing this in the classroom with my students, I would do certain parts of it in different colors, because I'm big on color and it gives the children something visual to see. My O-S-T, moose, tis, and nt, hopefully you can see those at the end of each one of those verbs. And you notice I wrote them in the exact same layout as the O-S-T, moose, tis, nt on your sheet. I never allow the children to do them in any order but that, because it logically gives them a picture in their head. The singular are here, the plural are here. It's always in these three rows, and it helps them remember it better. So that O-S-T, moose, tis, nt, those are the endings. So for do, it's I give. Das is you give. Dot, he, she, or it gives. Damus, we give. Datis, y'all give. Don't, they give. So for each individual verb, then we chant them. Do, das, dot, damus, datis, dant. Lavo, lavas, lavat, lavamus, lavatis, lavant. And I actually have them sing them because it works really cool with the Mexican hat dance song. You can actually conjugate a verb while, you know, to the tune of the Mexican hat dance song. It's amazing. And the kids love it. But again, it helps them get it in their heads. So that's the conjugation of each one of those verbs. Both of those verbs belong to the first conjugation. And you'll notice that there's an A before those personal endings, and that tells the student that they're first conjugation verbs. And let's see, Mark, do we have until 20 after?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to jump into some sentences here and see what we can have you do. Can we see these okay? Okay, now this is kind of different, because I think when I've done this talk before, we've actually gone English to Latin, and this time I decided to go Latin to English, just to see what you could do with it. So the first sentence is puella equum lavat. And so if I was doing this sentence with the children, they would have already memorized that puella means girl, and that equus means horse, and that lavo means I wash. So if we look first at the verb, can somebody tell me who is doing the washing? Okay. Well, you're definitely jumping ahead of me, but that's good. In this case, it is the girl. But if we just look at the verb lavat, it's going to be a he, a she, or an it, okay, because of the T. Now, how do we know? I don't know who said that. Who said it was the girl? Okay, how do you know it's the girl?
Well, because I was looking ahead.
Well, that's good. I like that.
I'm sorry.
That's great.
Because I had looked in the equum.
Yeah. Great. Okay, so what Jennifer is saying, when she looked at the word equum, if you go back to your first sheet where I gave you the case endings, you'll see that equus as a noun, if it has a UM on the end, it can only be a direct object. Okay? We talked about, we have some times where we've got the same endings and we've got to think a little bit more about what noun job it would be doing. But in this case, equum can only be the direct object. And if we look at puella, and we go back to the chart for first declension nouns, we do have a couple different options there. But because it's the first word in the sentence, in this case it is the subject noun. And then this matches up because that ending, the T ending on the verb, tells us that it has to be a he, she, or it doing it. Okay? So we end up with the horse washes the girl. Right. The girl washes the horse. And I could switch those words around, and no matter where I put them, it can only mean the girl washes the horse. Okay? Now, Latin word order does tell us that the subject should usually be first, the direct object is in the middle, and the verb is at the end. And the kids kind of like that because it's like Yoda. Okay? If you're familiar with that, when Yoda speaks, he always puts his verb at the end. So, you know, we tell the kids, well, that's cool, you know, because you can be like Yoda and put your verb at the end. Now, when we move to the second one, we have Maria aqua equos lavat. Does somebody want to take a stab at that one? This one's a little trickier. If somebody wants to try the whole sentence. Yeah, great. Okay, so Mary washes the, well, say, yeah, horses. Yeah, good. And you're a perfect beginning Latin student because the kids always go for the singular first. And then you have to go like this, and they say, oops, that's plural. Okay, so here we have Mary, again, as the subject noun. Mary washes the horses because os for equus can only be a plural direct object. And then aqua, this is kind of tricky. It's the prepositional phrase with water. And sometimes there are prepositions in Latin, and sometimes we use them and sometimes we don't, and that's way too complicated for our time today. But, yeah, that would be a prepositional phrase. If you're familiar with Shirley Grammar, you always put parentheses around the prepositional phrase. So I use a lot of Shirley Grammar in my Latin teaching. The next one is Maria puellis equum dot. We want to take a stab at that one. Yeah, good. Okay, and we could say that two different ways. Again, Mary is our subject noun, gives is our verb, horse is our direct object. And I think you said to the girls, okay? And that's a prepositional phrase way of talking about an indirect object. We could also say Mary gives the girls a horse. Okay, so this becomes our indirect object. And again, it's when we talk about Latin being an inflected language, we mean that it's about these endings. Okay, it's not about word order. Although I'm giving you the proper word order for Latin that I would teach the students, but we could shuffle them all around and it doesn't change the meaning of the sentence. Okay, the next one is puellae mariae aequos dant. Okay, the girls give okay. Yeah, good. Okay, right. Aequos is plural. So the girls give horses to Mary. Okay. And then here I've gone plural on you and put the plural ending on the verb so that we have nt there instead of just the T. And so this has to match with our subjects. So if we have a plural subject, then our verb must be plural as well. And we have retained that in English, even though we don't think about it, but that's true. He sings is different than they sing. Okay, so that's when we say that English is still mildly inflected. We still see a little bit of that there. And so the students have to learn. And again, they always think of everything in singular. Even when they want it to be plural, they still put the singular endings on it, and then they have to go back and think about it. And the last one is puellae mariae aequum lavant. Yeah. For this one, it's the genitive. So here we've got the subject noun, the girls wash, direct object is horse, Mary's horse. In this case, I use the genitive singular on Maria, Mariae. So it's Mary's horse. It's still, let's see, right, why, because I chose it that way, would it be, are you asking, could it be the horse for Mary, is that what the question is, could it be the dative, which it would be, so would you try and translate the horse for Mary, is that what you're asking? It's possible that could be correct as well. There are some, when we say that to for, there are specific things that the students have to learn that every time they want to say, use to as a preposition, they don't necessarily use the dative case. So there are nuances there that that they have to learn. But in that particular case, I think that might work, that either one would be fine. And so, again, depending on the context, if there was a larger context and we already established that it was Mary's horse, that might lead you to say, oh, it should be genitive, or maybe it wouldn't be. But, yeah, that's a good question. I think that one could actually go either way. So that gives you just a brief introduction. That's the kind of thing that you would see in a beginning Latin course, a first-year course. They would also then add in adjectives, which I have done in the past during this talk. Adjectives are interesting because they also have gender because they're modifying nouns, and so they have endings too, and the kids have to think about all that. But the basic idea of nouns and verbs, like we've just talked about in a few brief moments, that's what you would spend a majority of your time on during the first year in a Latin class, learning these declension endings, these two sets for the first and second declension, feminine and masculine, the basic first conjugation verbs, and then learning to work with adjectives and so on. So that gives you a taste for it. It's a lot of fun. Kids really do, they find it enjoyable. The memorizing of the endings comes very easily for them. It's a lot harder for us, I think. I have come up with songs, chants, pictures, you know, you name it. Most of them I've come up with so I could learn them. And then I pass them out to the kids and say, well, if it helps for you, you know, if it helps you too, you know, that would be great. To summarize, although today, you know, my talk has been basically on the expendability or indispensability of Latin, I think it's important that we have to look at all areas of our lives in terms of these two questions. Especially in our homeschooling. We live in a time and in a country where our choices are absolutely endless. I think especially related to education and home education now compared to 25 years ago. We're blessed, although with that blessing comes the responsibility of having to choose what we're going to study. And so I've tried to sell you on Latin today. But I'd like to share a comment by Puritan commentator Matthew Henry. He said, "We need wisdom when two duties come in competition, to know which to give the preference to, which must be determined by the circumstances. Opportunities are to be improved, and those opportunities first and most vigorously, which are likely to be of the shortest continuance, and which we see most speedily hastening away. That good duty which may be done at any time ought to give way to that which cannot be done but now." And certainly we as parents bear the responsibility for directing how our children fill and use their time until they reach adulthood. And as a former homeschooler myself, I know that that the choices are many and the pressures on us are great. As a tutor of approaching, 150 students over the past 7 years, I've become increasingly concerned about some of the choices that we're making, because there are so many things to choose from, whether it's band, sports, drama, Latin, you name it. There are so many things out there and so many opportunities. I have a lot of students who are so tired sometimes that they have trouble paying attention. Or they think that saying, "I was busy this weekend," is a valid reason for a lack of diligence in their studies. And I wonder sometimes if even we as Christian families are forgetting to spend time reading the Bible together with our children because we're so busy running to the next scheduled activity. And so I want to return to our original definitions that we started with. What is expendable to you because it has little significance to your overall purpose? And what is indispensable and thus absolutely necessary? And I would urge you to think and pray and consider whether some of those good duties, which may be done at any time, ought to give way to that which cannot be done just now. We all have just 24 hours a day with our children, and I think sometimes as homeschoolers we tend to want to be overachievers, and we think that we've got to get it all in before they graduate and go off to college. And I think sometimes we're missing the bigger picture, so I would encourage all of us to just really be prayerful about that. I hope I've made a little bit of a case for why I think Latin is an important part of a curriculum. But I think we need to just be very careful and look at the opportunities the Lord has given us and recognize that our children have a whole lifetime to try many different things, and we don't have to do it all before they're 18. So, thank you.